this, the 21st day of February, 2020. Consumer Choice Radio is a project of Consumer Choice Center, and we're broadcasting to you on the Big Talker FM 106.7 out of Wilmington, North Carolina. I am one of your hosts, Yael Osofsky, coming to you from Vienna, Austria. And on the other line, I've got my crime-fighting co-host, Mr. David Clement. David, welcome to the program again, sir.
Yeah, another week, another radio program, another episode. So here we go.
Here we go. We're kind of in gear right now. We're in number one. We just shifted into first, everybody. So be sure you buckle in, and we're going to go through the gears here. Great program for you. If you'd like to subscribe to the podcast version, see all the show notes and everything, you can find that at consumerchoiceradio.com. Plenty of information there. You can subscribe in Spotify, on your normal podcast player, Overcast, whatever you might have, and give us a rating if you have a chance. If you'd like to say hello, if you've got any kind of suggestions for the program, just write to us, hello@consumerchoiceradio.com. Email is set up. We're there. We're listening to you as often as we can, and we're trying to digest everything that's happening from a consumer choice perspective. David, there's so much that we have gone through. I had so many clips that I had prepared, that I had ready to go, then things were changing in the news, and I tell you, it's been a crazy couple of days, but we're going to be centered here. We're going to try to focus. We've got great number of show notes here, plenty of great articles. We easily could slide into the Democratic debate. That's going to be pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
We've got some great wins.
Quite a show.
Consumer Choice Center as well that we'll get into. We had an amazing index on railway stations that went out, which was awesome. Some great articles by our colleagues and ourselves. A lot of stuff on cannabis. We got some free trade stuff. We're talking about upzoning, Vape Nation, Green New Deal. I mean, it's just it's a full set of cards here. I think the listeners are going to love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's. I know that in previous weeks we've called it basically the pinnacle of a consumer week, but this week also news-wise was certainly up to the challenge.
Well, I'm just going to hit you with one right out of the gate, David. Is that all right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that cool? You like being hit right out of the gate? All right, here's number one.
There we go.
You're definitely going to guess within 5 seconds who this is, and then we've got the killer. This might be a killer shot.
As well.
What a wonderful country we have. The best-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What did I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, House 1.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, House 2.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a summer camp. Forgive me for that. But where is your...
Hold on. A summer camp? I got a socialist summer camp.
A home. Which tax haven
New
do you
York,
have your home?
New York City, thank you very much. Yeah, well, and I pay all my home. Taxes. And I'm happy to do it because I get something for it.
Oh, my goodness. This was one of the major punches by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who made his debut on the stage to present his ideas about why he should be the Democratic candidate to face President Trump in the fall.
So, Yael, I mean, before we go into that exchange, I have a question for you on this. A lot of people feel that Bloomberg has bought his way onto the stage.
You don't say.
What do you think about that? Do you think that there should be, if you're self-funding, should there be limits? Should there be any contribution limits? What's your take on
the question? Here's the honest take. None of the process that we're witnessing, whether it be the debate or the primaries, none of that is actually a government function, right?
Yeah.
The parties are private. They set their own rules. Everything that's going out with the debates is set by the networks, CNN, MSNBC, and these are private rules that they make up. It didn't used to be this way. You know, most of the debates have been on ABC, on MSNBC, CNN, all this kind of stuff. It didn't used to be like that. It used to be just like the League of Women Voters, and they would partner maybe with a media outlet because they just wanted a good moderator. Has Bloomberg bought his way in? You know, maybe he has. Maybe he has, and the thing is the media loves it, because what is the media reliant on? Advertising. And what is Bloomberg
doing? Story.
Advertising.
Yeah, yeah. There was there was a good quote from Elizabeth Warren after the debate saying, I mean, the internet or Twitter obviously thinks that Bloomberg performed quite poorly. And President Trump has commented that he performed quite poorly. But Elizabeth Warren basically said, don't worry, Mike will spend another $100 million to try and erase that from your memory. Yeah,
you know why he didn't perform well, right?
No, let's hear it.
He didn't have the box.
Oh, yes. He didn't get to stand on the box to make him taller.
So let's listen to another. This is a criticism of Bloomberg from Warren. I only have one clip from her. You know, I don't think we learned anything new from her last night, but here's her on Bloomberg.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats.
Oh, ooh. It was a very rowdy crowd. I think it was out in Vegas, this one, but very rowdy.
Yeah.
Goodness. And from, you know, the hot takes that I'm seeing of the day was Bloomberg. And, you know, from a consumer choice perspective, we've got our reasons to not like Michael Bloomberg. Nanny of the year, banning big gulps, big funder of the anti-vaping movement. But, man, they were not taking it easy on poor Mike last night. That was
he definitely took a beating.
Crazy. And I think one of the good ones I had was I was actually very, very impressed by Mayor Pete.
Mm-hmm.
He had some good zings.
What was it? That...
I think he drew the contrast very well. I think he is really up to date, much more up to date. You know, he just looks like version 3.0 and everyone else is like trial version. They're like AOL. Sorry.
Well, he almost seems like he's been preparing for this for his whole life. I mean, it was pretty funny this was a little bit ago, five or six days ago, Klobuchar and Steyer couldn't name the president of Mexico. The only one who got it right was Mayor Pete, and it was like
get into that.
without any hesitation.
Here's a good one, I think, just to give you the opening salvo of Mayor Pete. He's talking about Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg.
Yes, we've got to wake up as a party. We could wake up 2 weeks from today, the day after Super Tuesday, and the only candidates left standing will be Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg, the two most polarizing figures on this stage. And most Americans don't see where they fit if they've got to choose between a socialist who thinks that capitalism is the root of all evil and a billionaire who thinks that money ought to be the root of all power. Let's put forward somebody who actually lives and works in a middle-class neighborhood in an industrial Midwestern city. Let's put forward somebody who's actually a Democrat. Look.
That I think right there is the most devastating of the critiques, because obviously Bloomberg has a colorful history of switching parties and being a Republican and a Democrat and an independent and throwing around third party runs. And then obviously Bernie has been this super, super strident independent. News broke just this week that he had seriously considered trying to primary Barack Obama.
Yeah, I saw that.
In for his re-election, so like some real disruptive stuff.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, I think that's someone who's actually a Democrat is a pretty good slogan.
Yeah.
Although Pete certainly has his own bag of issues policy-wise, but I think that's probably an effective strategy.
Let's listen to the rest of the clip here.
We shouldn't have to choose between one candidate who wants to burn this party down and another candidate who wants to buy this party out. Look, we can do better.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. I like it.
Yeah, I think that's good. He's really playing into the, you know, the themes and the lines, and he knows it well. And I've got a lot more Pete clips because I was actually very surprised, and he held his own. One is that he went against Amy Klobuchar. This is
yes,
huge.
They had a bit of a fight.
Let's hear this one.
You're staking your candidacy on your Washington experience. You're on the committee that oversees border security. You're on the committee that does trade. You're literally in part of the committee that's overseeing these things. And we're not able to speak to literally the first thing about the politics of the country to ourselves.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
This is a race for president. If winning a race for Senate in Minnesota translated directly to becoming president, I would have grown up under the presidency of Walter Mondale.
Oh, callback. And also extra points for using literally, I think, four times.
Yes. Wow. So, absolutely devastating.
Let me play the rest.
I do.
It's very, very good.
Yeah.
This is different. And the reason that I think we need to talk about Washington experience is that we should ask what that experience has led to. Experience is, and certainly tenure, is not always the same thing as judgment. We're going to talk about votes in the Senate in Washington.
Let's talk about a major policy. Next question.
I just wanted to go to the end of that because he goes, hello, hello, hello. Oh, my
God. Yeah. I mean, what an exchange. It's interesting to see the guy who was the mayor of a small town ridicule Washington experience. But then at the same time, you listen to what he says and you're like, oh, OK, maybe he actually has a point. If Senator Klobuchar is in the room for all of these big discussions and then on the debate stage ridiculing all of the decisions, it's kind of like, well, where's your capacity to get it done? Maybe you're part of the problem.
Yeah. Whenever I hear him talk, it's too much inside baseball. It's like, I sponsored this bill. I sent an amendment to that bill. I think that would just confuse everyday people.
Well, a lot of people don't really know how government works in that way. So it just, for the most part, goes over their head because people don't, rightfully don't understand the bill process or amendments or pork barreling or all of these other terms that go through with legislation because they're too busy just doing whatever they got to do in their daily lives.
So she could not let this slide. She had to clap back.
Yeah. I wish everyone was as perfect as you, Pete, but let me tell you what it's like to be in the arena.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's almost a little throwback to Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports telling AOC, "Welcome to the Thunderdome," when she argued with him on Twitter.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
Yeah, and here's Amy's full response. I'll be fair here. Consumer Talks Radio here. We try to play all sides. You know, we're broadcasting here on the Big Talker FM, ConsumerChoiceRadio.com. We're fair to all candidates. We would welcome all candidates onto the program as well, by the way. We'd love to debate ideas, how they impact normal everyday people, how it's going to impact consumers, taxes, regulations. We'd love to hear it. So let's give Amy a little bit of a retort.
Ted Kennedy asked me to work on the first immigration bill. We were able, with President Bush, to at least get that bill to a vote. I'm sorry, but Senator Sanders actually opposed that bill, and I worked on it. And if we had gotten that bill done, there would have been a path to citizenship for so many people. Then I worked on the 2013 bill. I'm actually so proud of the work I've done on immigration reform. And you know what? You have not been in the arena doing that work.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
You've memorized a bunch of talking points and a bunch of things, but I can tell you one thing. What the people of this country want, they want a leader that has the heart for the immigrants of this country.
It's a strange world out there.
Wow. Clap back.
That's a pretty good clap back. But I think when she says, if you polled your average American and she's talking about Ted Kennedy, how many people are going to be like, wait, who?
Yeah, even then, she's going to think it's like, isn't there like one of the sons in there, like grandsons? Is she talking about that guy?
Yeah, she's going back to the Bush administration, and it's like, wait, what?
Yeah, that's way too long ago.
We understand. I mean, we're like in the mix, and it's part of our job to follow these things on a daily basis. But for Mayor Pete, I did like the line about memorizing talking points, and I think that could be a fair criticism. But I think for the average person, they're listening to her and they're like, wait, people debated immigration during the Bush administration? I mean, obviously they did, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, for the normal voter, the Bush administration is 9/11, Afghanistan, the Iraq War, and that's it.
9/11. And there was a lot of talk about health, about fitness,
yep.
Whether people, you know, would submit their medical records. And Amy Klobuchar mm-hmm. had a great line that reminds us of a truthism.
And they were talking a lot about heart conditions up here. We have a president right now that doesn't have a heart.
He doesn't have a heart. Somebody should go check on Trump. How is he still alive? Yeah. I don't know if you have any other thoughts. I didn't watch the entire debate. We saw a couple clips, you know, the good things coming through. I mean, this is like the umpteenth debate. I don't know if we need to go more into the ideas. There's a lot more on healthcare and yeah. But either way, hopefully, people are a little bit entertained by that because there's going to be some good lines, and we'll see in 2 weeks when, all this is kind of done, Super Tuesday's over, and, we could have a crown champion. We could have somebody who comes in and swoops in at the convention, someone like a Bloomberg or a Hillary Clinton. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, yeah, so I think the real question coming out of the debate is going to be if Warren's performance – helps her surge and pulls people away from Bernie, which could help whomever the moderate at the top of each state. Like if they can pull Bernie down, so let's say you have Warren at between 15 to 18%, you have Bernie between 18 and 22%, and then whomever the moderate leading in each particular state is at 22-24%. That's a path to victory for a Mike Bloomberg, for a Mayor Pete, for a Klobuchar, for Biden. If they can hold at that low 20s number, they may actually have a shot here of stealing a couple states. But then again, obviously the flip side is the presence of Mayor Bloomberg. He is certainly on the moderate side of the Democrats, and does he basically put the nail in the coffin for Joe? Does he stifle Mayor Pete and Senator Klobuchar's momentum? It's still too early to tell where the polls will swing at post-debate, but there's a lot of moving pieces here. And the performance by Warren and the presence of Michael Bloomberg definitely make that next conversation a lot more interesting.
Yeah, and one thing that they did invoke a lot, and you heard that back in the both Buttigieg clip and Bloomberg, you know, socialism is on trial. Bernie Sanders is going to be the last man standing, and he'll go very far. He's raising a lot of money. A lot of young people really like him. He's got a lot of endorsements. He's not bowing out anytime soon. So, yeah, it's going to be crazy. Much more we can say about that. There are some good clips that we've put at consumerchoiceradio.com in the show notes. You can follow up on that. I actually got most of my clips from Barstool Sports Net, the news Instagram. They're actually doing a pretty good job on that. David, we got a couple other topics I wanted to get to.
Mm-hmm.
One relates to harm reduction, Vape Nation. This is huge. This is an article mm-hmm. Vice. It turns out that there's a study that was done before that, you know, talked about the vaping panic, saying that vaping could lead to a heart attack. I mean, this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. It was in the American Heart Association's scientific journal. And it turns out that they have totally retracted that study. The editor, mm-hmm. quote, "are concerned that the study conclusion is unreliable," quote. I mean, this is huge. A retraction of a scientific paper, especially one that has fomented the fake outrage, the fake crisis that everyone heard about when it came to vaping all throughout the summer and throughout the fall months, and, you know, led to some really bad legislation, not just in the U.S., but really around the world.
It feels uncomfortably similar to the anti-vaccine paper that was originally published in Lancet that was then retracted. Which was great that it was retracted because the findings were bogus, but for the most part, the damage had been done in terms of swaying popular opinion and kind of giving birth to people who had really strong opinions that weren't based on the available evidence. And so the real devastating impact here is that it's almost impossible to quantify the impact that this paper originally had in terms of guiding legislation or causing kind of this panic and overreaction. And what's the human cost of that?
Yeah.
In terms of people having safer alternatives and harm reduction models and whatnot. And so it's great that it's retracted, but it's very sobering in terms of the fact that the damage has been done, because that dominated the headlines for weeks.
It's a strange world out there.
Yeah, that's true. And
yeah,
one good quote that just came out recently, this is from Joachim Schutz. I was actually wondering mm-hmm. if you would be able to pronounce this very well.
Me? No.
He's the head of Environment and Radiation at the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer. Consumer Choice mm-hmm. Center has got a pretty good video clip that we put together on that. He actually said, this is the quote, "E-cigarettes are in no way as harmful as tobacco cigarettes and actually could help heavy smokers to quit." This goes against a lot of the statements that This is my quote now. Mm-hmm. This goes against a lot of the statements of actual public health officials, even the World Health Organization itself on its Twitter page, you know, when we were in the midst of the coronavirus stuff, was posting all this garbage about how vaping was just as dangerous as smoking and just, yep. you know, we need more regulations here. And it's just insane that it's come to this. Guys on Reddit have been more correct than international global public health. That's sad.
What? Yeah, and I went back, I guess it would have been a few months ago when India banned all vaping devices. A World Health Organization account basically shared the announcement and congratulated them for doing so.
And they probably used a clap emoji as well.
Yeah, it's just like, ugh, what is going on? I mean, these are the people we're supposed to trust to get it right. And so to see them consistently get it wrong, hopefully Joachim, is that how you pronounce his first name?
Joachim.
Hopefully he can be the rational person in the room and help guide the discussion towards harm reduction, whether it be for tobacco harm reduction or hard drug harm reduction or anything along those lines, really just embracing those principles. So, maybe there's hope for the World Health Organization, but we'll see.
You are listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM, out on the radio live every Saturday at 10 a.m. Also in podcast form, we've got a couple other stories here. And David, I thought because we got you on the program, and obviously you're an expert in many things, it'd be time to look up north again. We've got some stories
yep.
in Canada. Big deal. Big deal.
Mm-hmm.
This is related to the environment. This mm-hmm. has to do with blockades. So I'll play a small introductory clip. I think listeners want to hear what you think about it. This has been huge in Canada. This is kind of bringing the entire country to a standstill. So let's yep. listen to the introductory clip, and then we can get into it.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. The dispute over a natural gas pipeline in northern BC continues to have repercussions across the country. Via Rail is temporarily laying off 1,000 employees because the blockades on rail lines have interrupted most of its services, the first time that's happened in Via's 42-year history. The blockades have now gone on for almost 2 weeks. Today, another one was set up on a rail line near the historic Victoria Bridge in Montreal, and another went up on the CN main line in Edmonton.
All right, so David, before we get into this, what is going on here? Is it crazy environmental people? Is it terrible gas companies? I mean, what is happening here? It seems as if the entire country of Canada has just lost its collective head here.
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a real divide. Basically, in a nutshell, there are pipeline infrastructure questions. In terms of building pipelines to transport natural resources across the country. And there are some on the environmental side of politics or some in indigenous communities who vehemently oppose these pipeline expansions. And so in response, they've built these blockades on major rail lines that have, for the most part, shut down, I mean, for the entirety of the eastern part of the country. So almost everything from Toronto east, the CN rail lines were shut down. So no trains were traveling at all because of these blockades.
Companies, right? There are private train companies that can avoid that, right?
To my understanding, no. So this would be all of your crude shipments, all of your Via Rail, which is like the Canadian version of Amtrak. They were canceling service just because of the prevalence of these blockades. And I think some of it was being cautious in terms of other blockades possibly popping up. And you have a real question of, so in Canada, there is kind of a duty to consult Indigenous communities in terms of these projects, and you have an internal divide in the Indigenous community between the hereditary chiefs. So these are the people who assume positions of power and authority basically by blood or by birth. And then you have elected chiefs, and largely the divide is the hereditary chiefs oppose pipeline expansion, but the elected chiefs agree with these pipeline expansions, and they actually make the argument very passionately in favor for them because they provide a means of income for a lot of people. And for those who don't know, Indigenous Canadians are historically the most marginalized and impoverished people in Canada based on a variety of really ugly circumstances over the past 200 years. And so they make the argument in favor because this finally gives people in their communities the means to make an honest, to make a great living financially and really kind of pull themselves up out of poverty. And so, I mean, the consequences here are drastic. There's, for the most part, things are at a standstill. The prime minister, basically everybody's waiting for the prime minister to do something about it. There are questions of whether or not the justice minister, or the attorney general, or anyone in the federal government can order the RCMP to basically tear down these blockades. There's questions of whether or not they're even lawful. I mean, it's one thing to protest. It's another thing to basically cause the economy to come to a standstill and do so by risking people's safety, because obviously if by chance there was a train that was going and a blockade had been set up and there wasn't time to stop, it's the consequences there would be pretty tragic. And now there are counter protests who are showing up to basically remove all of the stuff from the railroad tracks, and it's super confusing, super complicated. I think a lot of people are wondering what the prime minister is going to do. I think 62 or 65% of the country thinks that these blockades are not appropriate. So there's certainly a majority of the country who thinks that this needs to stop. But it's just a disaster.
It's important to kind of talk about this because this could be the future if, you know, we're all looking to do Green New Deals everywhere and people become so anti-energy. You know, this is just over a couple of pipelines. You know, just imagine if you have a Bernie Sanders kind of socialist administration in the United States and essentially says, okay, no more oil production anywhere, no more shipping, none of it. And basically you would have this on a mass scale for a country 10 times the size, and that would, like, bring everything to a screeching halt. I mean, it's a small peer into the future. You know, usually the U.S. is maybe, like, 2-3 years ahead of Canada, but Canada's way ahead here. I don't know if it's a positive thing. You know, it'd be interesting to see how this works out. We'll play one clip that does a bit more in depth and does a kind of a field report.
The sounds of traditional drums rang out on the rails on the western edge of Edmonton, signaling more support of the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs.
Get Coastal GasLink to respect Wet'suwet'en law and remove themselves from their territory, along with the Royal Colonial Mounted Police.
Later in the day, a manifestation of the frustration that some are feeling. Some residents arrived saying the Prime Minister isn't doing anything, so they were going to take action and began dismantling the blockade. That frustration is being felt and voiced in Ottawa, where opposition leaders continue to demand a solution to the nearly 14-day standoff.
So once again, can he tell people who are just laid off on what day they can get back to work?
Continuing to do everything we can to resolve this situation peacefully.
But some premiers are tired of waiting, so they held a conference call to discuss next steps that they can take to end the blockades.
We cannot exclude to use police, but it has to be done in coordination in every provinces at the same time.
I mean, look at that, Quebec making sense.
That's not an option the federal government is considering, calling instead for calm. But Alberta Premier Jason Kenney says that ideal and the economy are being hijacked in the process.
Reconciliation doesn't mean allowing a couple of people to shut down the national economy.
This is looking bad. Hopefully we'll have more developments here. I don't want it. I don't think any of us want it to just come down to like a political thing where they're deciding in the House of Commons. You know, these are ordinary people who they believe what they're doing is right. You know, and I think we need to be able to share the actual pain that a lot of people are feeling because they're not able to get to work. Entire parts of the economy are coming to a screeching halt. I mean, I've seen this over the last couple of weeks. There's been plenty of these blockades, people stopping bridges and all traffic, and guys are just trying to get to work, trying to put food on the table. And they might agree with the protesters, you know, in principle, but when it actually comes down to impacting their daily commute and their life and being able to get to their work, they start to change their sympathies a little bit.
Yep, and I think the big thing here is from the federal government's perspective, being slow to respond or inactivity could set a very dangerous precedent.
Oh yeah.
By exposing them, basically to say like, well, if you want anything done, all you need to do is be as disruptive and as inconvenient for everyone as possible. And then maybe the federal government will concede or listen to you. So it does set a bad precedent in that sense, because you could have any issue, whether legitimate or not, serious or not. If you had like Jason Kenney said, the Premier of Alberta, a handful of people who wanted to take actions this far, and they knew the police were not going to be instructed to do anything about it. It's a really terrible precedent.
Yeah, it's very bad. So we'll close out our Canada segment. Plenty of good news, you know, in other sectors, but unfortunately, in the looking down the barrel of crisis right now, it's not the best. Friends up north. There's plenty more to come on that. We'll have some more updates. Again, you can look at all the links at consumerchoiceradio.com. We're broadcasting on the Big Talker 106.7 FM. You know, David, we've been very serious and somber. We've been covering, you know, the big serious topics, big political, big environmental protest actions. Let's have a little bit of fun here, and let's talk about something that impacts you and me and everyone else who loves to sip on drinks: straw bans.
Yes.
Big deal. You see them happening in California and many other cities and municipalities. And thankfully, we've got our good friend, I'd love to say friend of the show, but there's no way he'll ever come on, Ronnie Chang, the comedian. So he's going to tell us a little bit about the straw police. They're the people who are empowered to stop and fine you for using a straw. I think it's from Trevor Noah, one of these programs. So let's
here in America, we use straws for everything. Drinking, snorting cocaine. Okay, just those two things. But still, that's not nothing.
Yet recently, local governments across the nation have been challenging our God-given right to bear straws.
Straws represent only 0.02% of the 9 million tons of plastic waste that is estimated. People would like to keep the plastic straw, just saying.
Conservative Big Bird actually has a point here. So I headed to Washington, D.C., the latest city to ban straws, to meet Lillian, an environmental inspector. Her actual job is to go into local businesses and make sure they're not using plastic straws. That's right, she's a straw cop.
So what do you hope to accomplish by banning something that's like 0.00000000001% of our trash?
You know, that's a good question. It's a perfect symbol for our overuse and dependence on single-use plastics, right?
So what am I supposed to do? If I don't use straws, what do you want me to do? You want me to do this?
Yes, absolutely. That's what I would love.
Lillian explained that over 40% of all plastic manufacturing is single-use, throwaway items that will take somewhere between 450 years and forever to disappear. But still, why are people suddenly so angry about straws?
Why do you hate straws so much? What did straws ever do to you?
I think that really started with the straw video, the plastic straw getting stuck up the sea turtle's nose. It has over 35 million views on YouTube.
Wait, this is all because of a dumb viral video?
Look, I've seen a lot of on YouTube. How bad could this be?
Turns out, really f***ing bad.
Man, it's a freaking straw.
Okay, I'm done. No more straws.
No more straws. That's the turtle video that everyone has seen. This is an actual position. You know, there are now people in place that cruise the restaurants, and if you and your establishment are passing out these straws, you are liable for a fine.
I mean, it's insane. There are restaurants in the United States where you can concealed carry a firearm, but you can't have a straw.
Well, that's why police is on the case.
It's so weird. And I mean, another big thing that almost never gets talked about. So, I mean, everybody cares about plastic pollution, but you have to talk about where plastic pollution actually comes from. I mean, 98% or something like that of all plastic pollution in the oceans doesn't come from from OECD countries. It comes from very poor countries who don't have infrastructure to dispose of waste. And they end up basically pushing it into the sea. That's a worthy discussion in terms of how do we solve that. But generally speaking, Americans and Canadians are not dumping their single-use plastic into the ocean. And then in terms of how long it takes for these things to go away, so he quoted 400 to forever, 400 years to forever. I mean, that really is all dependent on what the disposal mechanism is.
Yeah.
So a country like Sweden basically condenses all of their waste and turns it into a fuel source, burns it, captures all of the emissions safely, and they actually fuel energy production off of waste. And so it's almost like recycling all of this single-use plastic to heat homes and various other things like that. Yeah. They do a particularly good job of it. So there is a way of actually disposing of some of this waste in a way that isn't like 400 to forever years to decompose.
Let's check in with the straw police.
Random inspections, yeah. And we talk to business owners about the new rules and how to come into compliance with them.
That sounds great.
It was time for me to hit the streets and shadow Lillian on an actual straw raid. First step, case the joint.
Clear. All right, clear.
So once we enter a business, usually we kind of take a look around, right? We want to see if we can see any straws.
Is that racial profiling?
We're looking at the straws.
What race is more likely to use straws?
Definitely not the people.
Next, look for contraband.
So these are what we use.
Great.
Compostable.
Okay, that's excellent. So these are absolutely in compliance.
Turns out this guy was clean, at least for today. But I knew things were about to get real when we hit the mother lode. A coffee shop with enough plastic nose candy to take down Nemo's whole goddamn reef.
But it looks like these are plastic, right? So you are currently out of compliance.
That's right. You're busted. And now the straw cops are going to make you pay.
Right now, we haven't switched yet, but we are in the process of switching.
Okay. Oh, really? That's convenient. Just happened to be switching when we walk in. Okay.
So what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to give you a warning letter.
Wait, what do you mean warning letter?
So Lillian just walks around warning businesses? That's it. I'm taking the lead on this investigation.
Straw. We got straw over here. Are you crazy? Going to pull out a straw in front of a straw cop?
Sorry.
Is this your straw? Whose straw is this? Straw over here. Sorry, false alarm. It's fine. It's paper. Dispatch, we are entering premises. Over. You see that guy over there? The black hoodie? Just gonna go ask him a few questions. Oh, he's going. Go. Straw police. Drop the straw.
Straw police.
I mean, what's funny is like this is like the dystopian future of a Michael Bloomberg presidency.
Oh, there we go, everybody. We know what that is.
It's a strange world out there.
Way to go.
It is a strange world out there.
It is a strange world out there. You know?
Welcome to Thunderdome.
So that's there's plenty more of the Strzok. I've actually been wanting to play that clip for a couple of weeks. So glad I got to do that now.
Oh, that's good.
Okay, since we're in the funnies, you know, we've got a couple of Consumer Choice Center hits by some of our colleagues to get to. First, yep. I'd like to get something that actually relates very much to consumers. Very important yes. topic. Something that affects many people and apparently all of Twitter. It has to do with whether or not you should be able on a short-haul flight to recline your seat in economy. A lot of debate on this, a lot of opinions, lots of thoughts. And Dave, yes. I wanted to feature, I linked your tweet here in the show notes. I'll be quoting Mr. Clement here. If you recline in economy on a short-haul flight, you are legitimately a bad person.
Correct.
Defend
I
your
stand
remarks,
by
sir.
That. Yes, you are a bad person. If you are reclining in economy on a short-haul flight, you're a bad person.
Is it the pitch? Is it the degrees? If they go all the way, what if they, you know, just give it a click, you know, just an inch or two?
I mean, sure. If you are going to look to recline, you should ask. You should look behind you first. Be courteous. Make sure they don't have a laptop out or coffee, which has happened to me twice. Once where the guy in front of me on a 50-minute flight decided with his entirety of his weight to jam his seat back as far as it could go, and he snapped my laptop screen. I've seen people do that and spill coffee all over the people behind them.
You've been traumatized by a past experience.
I certainly have.
Wow.
Where it could have been completely avoided if he had just turned around and said, hey, sir, I'm going to recline my chair. And then I would have moved my things accordingly so that didn't happen.
Well, I think if we have the ability to do so, to recline, you know, there's no limits. If we have the ability, we should be able to. I do think you're right. We got to be courteous. Usually what I do is I give the slow creep, right? So you
yes.
click it in place. Give the slow creep, kind of give them the sign that you're kind of moving it back. Usually you're not going to go all the way back. But let's admit it, you know, a lot of these flights and seats, it seems as if they're just leaning you forward like at least 30 degrees. You're just trying to get even. I'm just trying to go, perpendicular here.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. If you're flying from Europe to New York City, I mean, that's a long flight. I can totally understand trying to get comfortable to sleep. That's understandable. But if you're on a short flight and you're that guy, like, I mean, I've had horror stories of I had a short flight to Cuba. The woman in front of me, with all of her weight, jammed her seat back. Her hair was coming through the gap into my tray. Just like really like poor etiquette stuff that you'd never get away with in other kind of like travel situations. So I am definitely anti-recline. And if you do need to recline, obviously some people do, you should ask.
Yeah.
Or at least notify them and be courteous in that way.
I'm going to go with the creeper method, you know, just kind of slowly creep back, be courteous. Always look out for laptops, coffee, small children, puppies. Be sure you got nothing in the way. But if you just kind of back, even give it a beep.
Beep. Yep. Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah, but either way, there's a recline function on those seats for a reason. Not always comfortable, but who knows if we maybe deregulate a little bit, if we allow a little bit of innovation into how our airplanes are built and work and fly in the sky, maybe we can get some nice, more comfortable beds for people in economy. But who knows? That day is not here yet. You're listening to
Consumer what do you think?
Radio on the Big Talker FM. What do I think about...
I was going to say, what do you think about the idea of, for short flights, just removing the ability to recline in economy?
Why would you do that? That is literally removing consumer choice.
No, what I'm saying is, what if various planes were to offer or were to remove that from economy as a means of giving people more space or legroom?
the button for more legroom. That's never going to happen. Because you have that on Ryanair and some of these, you know, budget airlines. You cannot go back. And it's not as if you got more room. They just, like, put more seats in there.
Yeah, but you can also pay like $8 to fly from like London to Rome, Ryanair. So, I will exchange nobody being able to recline for a discount flight between two major cities.
Where do you weigh in on the seat recline debate? Write us. Hello at consumerchoiceradio.com. All right, so here we got a couple of media hits from the Consumer Choice. Some great stuff this week. My goodness. Number one is we did release, and our colleagues wrote, the European Railway Station Index. Who'd have thunk it? If you put up a listicle of the greatest and most passenger-friendly railway stations, you rank them, you put it online, you provide the methodology. We've now been featured in over 110 outlets. It's been everywhere from The Independent. It's been mentioned on Yahoo. It's been mentioned in a lot of the wire agencies in Europe. And even a lot of the train stations themselves have taken up on social media and shared our index. It's just insane how crazily fast this spread. People love weighing in on this stuff. I mean, I think people love weighing in on travel rankings anyway, and they love it. So I think this is a huge win. Actually, I'm looking here at the KPIs. Over 100 media hits, 80% of them in Germany, because there was a lot of German stations there. On the website, there was over 6,000 views in just 3 days. We had it on Die Welt, a big German newspaper. It was shared on Facebook over 3,000 times, 10,000 impressions on Twitter. We had like the Statistica charts website, where they typically do nice-looking charts. They actually republished our index. The Italian embassy in Switzerland is all gung-ho about it. The St. Pancras station in London, which was number one on the list, they shared it on their page. Even Deutsche Bahn, the German railway company monopoly, they shared this on their website, you know, touting their investments and all the rest. Some great hits from our Consumer Choice Center colleagues there. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite. The response has been incredible, and I think what's interesting is it's very nice to frame these services or these travel outlets that we use to frame them in the context of, well, how do they best serve consumers? And I think that that's where a lot of the buzz comes from, because we've done this before with airports, and now we've done it with train stations, and it just gets people talking about, okay, well, why does this train station actually have all of this cool stuff? Why doesn't this train station have all of this cool stuff, or have these travel options, or this availability, or lounges, or anything like that? So you
can't have this in Canada because you had a blockade.
Yeah,
won't be any good scores, at least here in the short term, about that.
Well, yeah, and what's funny is that's actually part of the reason why the French stations did so poorly, is because I forget what the number is, but the average strike days per year that derails service in France is really, really high, because those guys go on strike for, it seems like, anything. What good is a cool rail station if 35, 40 days of the year they're on strike and there's no service?
This has happened to me a couple of times going to Paris and trying to get from the airport, and you really have no option apart from an Uber. Ubers were themselves outlawed in France, so your options are pretty limited, and that's very unfortunate. So yeah, you should definitely check that out. Go to consumerchoicecenter.org. You can definitely see the index there. Check it out, how it ranks. We'd love to do this in the United States. We'd love to do this in other countries. You know, I think these rankings are good. They give you a good sense, as you mentioned, of the passenger experience, the consumer experience. Look, it's not all just about price. It is also about all the comforts and all the amenities they provide. There's so much more that you could obviously investigate, but that's very good. Next, Consumer Choice Center media hits. So I had a pair of articles that came out. One is on the Chinese Communist Party, and we've talked about that on this program plenty, David. This one is about the hack of the credit reports at Equifax. This happened a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago, and this was a hack that affected a third of the country, almost half of the United States, so the population.
Yep.
Huge data breach back in 2017, names, social security numbers, addresses, credit history. I mean, this was a huge deal. We thought it was just like hackers who wanted to take credit card data, but as it turns out, there was an indictment from the Justice Department last week, and turns out it was the handiwork of four members of the Chinese Communist Party's military who were hacking away and got all this data. And does that mean that, you know, they wanted us to take our credit cards? Or does it mean that they want to put us in their social score database? It's pretty scary to think about. A lot of stuff. What are we supposed to do in liberal democratic countries when we have, you know, Communist Party military rogue actors, you know, hacking our credit reports? It's a scary thought.
It changes your perspective. I mean, it's one thing. You often think like, oh, okay, hackers trying to like gain access to things for private gain or identity theft, and that's pretty serious. And then you're like, oh, wait a second, it's the it's the Chinese Communist Party. This is a whole nother level of scary. Yeah.
That's pretty bad. And one other article that I got published in a few newspapers in the U.S. about timeshares. Are timeshares the ultimate vacation racket? This came about because I myself was pitched a timeshare. I think everybody might have a timeshare story. I had booked something. I think it was Hilton Hotel. And then I was transferred to their timeshare department, and they wanted me to come out to Vegas, and you know, they put me up for 2 nights, 3 days in this beautiful resort. All I had to do was go listen to a sales pitch. I didn't think anything of it, and then I started doing a bit more research. I understood kind of what the timeshares are. Yeah, this is a very crooked sort of established sector. I mean, there's obviously a lot of hardworking entrepreneurs and people who are trying to provide great products, but yeah, there's a lot of people getting swindled in this. This is pretty crazy, and I can definitely see a lot of older people who might, you know, want to have a vacation home who can't afford it. Maybe they find one of these services. Maybe they have a good one. You know, there are plenty of stories of great timeshares, but a lot of times people are kind of getting hoodwinked into some of these contracts.
Yeah, so I'm not too familiar. Walk me through where, like, is this one of those things where they bury it in the fine print? Is it – how are people getting – Getting deceived.
So normally how it works, you go to the pitch. It's in a nice, you know, resort conference room. There's an open bar. They kind of, you know, keep everybody juiced up. They have a couple of slick presentations. They got PowerPoint on the screen. And then you have the sales reps that come to you, talk about your situation, talk about your finances, what you want in a vacation home. And they kind of, you know, have these packages of, you know, oh, you can stay at this resort and you can actually own this property, be part of the timeshare system. And a lot of the contracts say, hey, you know, you just put this down, this deposit. But it is true in the fine print. It's not just that you get access to this. You need to pay access fees. You're only able to book it at particular times of the year. There are maintenance fees that usually go up pretty high that they don't tell you that in the very beginning. And, you know, this is because you're dealing with usually with different legal jurisdictions, different countries. You've got people who are signing over contracts for a piece of property in the Dominican Republic or, you know, Aruba or something like this, where, you know, the law doesn't even really recognize some of these timeshares. And sometimes you just have the case where people show up and it looks absolutely nothing like what they saw in the presentation.
A lot of
shadiness there. There's a lot of fraud, a couple of lawsuits out there. So there's little interesting things to kind of think about there. I'm only starting to research this. I know there's a lot of my family members who were kind of pressured to sign, and some did. Some regret it. But I think this is someone that, you know, at least something that people have probably heard about. So, David, we're in the last couple of minutes here of the program. We've got a nice list of links and things in the show notes. Let me hand it over to you. What do you want to cover here? There's obviously some great things in the cannabis space, free trade, upzoning, some more craziness from the Democrats. What do you think?
I think one big thing, and I'll bring this up because it's something that I've been talking about, feels like for almost 2 years. So some recent survey data came out in regards to Canadian consumers of cannabis, and 1/3 of Canadian cannabis consumers don't know what brand they bought, which sounds really, really strange, because if you were to ask all consumers, okay, what beer do you buy? Everyone would know. They would know, oh, I buy Bud, or I buy Stella, or I buy Molson Canadian, or Labatt's, or Michelob Ultra. They would know what they've purchased either at a restaurant or a club or for at their house. And so it's very strange that you have 1/3 of Canadian consumers who don't know what they purchased. And I think a lot of that comes down to the really heavy-handed regulations that the government's put in place that make it illegal for these brands to really develop and to build awareness. And it's a huge disservice to consumers, because imagine you, if you, I mean, I know that you enjoy a nice hard seltzer every now and then. Imagine not knowing, being like, oh, what type of hard seltzer is that? And you're like, oh, I don't know, actually.
I don't know. As a warning label, that's all I know.
Yeah, it's like, oh, actually, I forget, because I have, there's no brand awareness, there's no marketing, there's no kind of consumer education in that sense. And so the survey results, it's a little bit of vindication for people. They're not vindication. It's a little bit of proving our arguments right, in the sense that we've talked about how there are negative aspects to these heavy-handed regulations. And I've speculated for a long time that it's going to mean an uninformed consumer base. And I mean, obviously, with 33% of consumers being completely uninformed, that doesn't even get into different product varieties, like the different strains of cannabis and all sorts of things. I can only assume that if you were to do like an uninformed consumer index, that that number would go up as you add in additional variables in terms of what people are buying. So it's definitely a moment where we've been proven right in our kind of projections on why certain policies are bad.
Definitely. And there's a lot more. You can read a lot of David's criticisms and articles on consumerchoiceradio.com. Check out our show notes. Subscribe to the podcast version if you can, and Spotify and your Apple Podcasts, wherever you do get your podcast. Get plenty more analysis, some great shows. I will actually be broadcasting from the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, in D.C. next week, hoping to get some good interviews for the program, some good fodder for David to poke his stick through. So some interesting things. David, it's been a pleasure, been an honor. Great to catch up with you. And we'll hopefully cover more of these topics going forward.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. And until next week, again, remember, if you want to reach out to us, feel free to tweet your questions, comments to us. Follow us on our various social media platforms, and keep listening to the show.
All right, and we'll be back next week with more Consumer Choice Radio.